In 2020, the pandemic brought everyone's life to a staggering halt. Stuck at home, most of us started working on ourselves, getting fit, learning a new skill, or catching up with friends. There were others who lived away from their families, who got stranded, and who couldn't go back. For so many of us, finding our way home to our family was what gave us hope and comfort. In just this instance, we can see and understand the value of family during one of the most trying times in humanity, which is why growing up in a nurturing family gives a child love and a sense of belonging. Globally, the primary causes for parents not being able to provide basic needs to their children is due to poverty, and this leads to many children being separated from their family and placed in institutional care. And as we learned in previous episodes, childcare institutions help take care of the basic needs of a child, like food, shelter, clothing, education, and a safe space for those in situations of extreme risk. CCIs do their best to provide family-like care, but it still isn't really family. So is there a way to prevent the separation of children from their family while ensuring that the child is safe and the family is able to provide for them? Welcome to Care of the State, a podcast by Catalyst for Social Action that sheds light on what happens to orphaned and vulnerable children in India. On this episode of Care of the State, we're going to talk about the different kinds of care options children have apart from institutional care. Ian Anand Forber-Pratt, the Director of Global Advocacy for Children's Emergency Relief International, lists out these alternative options of care.
I'll start with sponsorship, because sponsorship is a lot like something globally we call kinship care, which is the idea of children living with their families and their communities and getting sponsored, getting some money to support them so that they can remain with family instead of coming into institutional care. Sponsorship in general in India doesn't clearly to have a case management role along with it, meaning that you actually have a case manager that is supporting that family. It is more, at least as it was designed, more of a financial aspect of things. But luckily, throughout the field, we're getting into really understanding that families and children need support, though not forever. You create a dependency if you're giving them support forever. But helping families basically get their own agency, their own ability, and seeing them as strong. Other than sponsorship, then you have the provision of foster care and group foster care. They're kind of clubbed together, but they're actually very different care provisions. So foster care is the provision of a family or individual being licensed to take care of children in their home. Then for group foster care, it's actually a facility that is licensed, not an individual. And that facility can have a higher number of children, up to 8 children. And that includes any biological siblings of the caretakers that are living in the home. Then the other provision is adoption. But adoption is a very legal, very permanent care provision, where basically a child's parents' rights are terminated or surrendered. And then the new adoptive family becomes the actual legal guardians of that child as if that child were a biological child. And that includes heredity and land rights and all of those things.
The UN Guidelines for the Alternative Care for Children, 2009, underlines the significance of family in a child's life, and that it's preferable that they stay in a residential setting among their own communities. This allows a child to have ties with a close support network that includes neighbors, friends, and relatives. This is important because it'll reduce any disruption to their social life as well as their education. It also makes it easier to reintegrate the children with their families and culture. Satyajit Mazumdar, head of advocacy at CSA, asks Ian about family-based care.
Why are family-based care options necessary? Why do you think they should be promoted?
So, when a child sees trauma, neglect, abuse, difficult situations in an institutional setting where they do not get the individual care. And let me be very clear, there are wonderful people in this world working in institutional settings that care deeply about children. But when you have that many children to one person, it is difficult or almost impossible to give the child the love and care that they need, that they get within a home. And so that child then is laying there crying, that child is learning that they have to act out to get attention, and their brain develops in a different way. And some of the internal pathways that the brain develops when you get love and nurturing and positive attention and positive attachments do not form and forever harms a child. The social aspects then come from the brain development, but also could develop without the brain development. The social aspects are the way that when you are in an institution and you're not learning the life skills, some of the relational skills, and you're not getting the positive time and attention from caring, appropriate, and safe adults, then you end up with everything from suicidalness to self-harm behaviors, to acting out behaviors, to mental health concerns. All of those things come from institutionalization. So a range of family-based care begins to address those issues. But it's very important to say that it just begins to address those issues. We actually have to look at child protection in a very different way. Unfortunately, globally, child protection has been about removing children from what a system calls our broken or not capable families and housing and protecting them in a very transactional, bureaucratic type of way. And that does not lead to healing, and it does not lead to strong communities. And the important thing about family-based care is that it puts the family in the driver's seat. It's saying to the family, we know that things are difficult. Maybe you've made bad decisions. Maybe your family has made bad decisions for generations. But maybe it's not your fault as well. Maybe there are different types of discrimination, inequalities in society that have led to your family not being able to move forward on your own way. And let us as a system help you in a family-based way with the family at the center as being strong and capable to be able to raise your own children in their best interests. And unfortunately, we have a system that is built the opposite, the removal way, to remove children. And money is based on removal of children and housing children, as opposed to them being in families.
While institutes do provide a roof over a child's head, it is also crucial to understand how it affects their mental well-being. Our host, Satyajit, asks Dr. Shekhar Seshadri, psychiatrist and professor of the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at NIMHANS, about the effects institutionalization has on the minds of vulnerable children.
So if you look at some of the experiences, for example, the Romanian adoption studies of Sir Michael Rutter and children who lived in institutions where there was hardly any stimulation, hardly any developmental activities, and the staff to children ratio was very skewed. If you have an institution with 100 children and perhaps two counselors, a house mother and house father, how much of individual attention do they give, and do they have structured activities that really take care of the developmental and emotional needs of these children? So these are the parameters that one need to keep in mind to really understand the structure, the routine, the staff-resident ratio, the extent to which developmental and life skills activities are structured, the background that children come from, their age, their cognitive level, and all these factors combine together to really make an impact on the development and emotional well-being of a child. And this is the reason why we need to empower our institutions.
There are so many factors which lead to these mental health issues or developmental issues with children in institutional care. What percentage of it would you attribute to institutional care by itself?
I will draw your attention to the whole pathways to vulnerability issue and some of the experiences that we have faced where children come from families that are neglectful and abusive, and in fact are complicit in the trafficking of the child, perhaps for labor, perhaps for sex work. And a child is rescued. The Child Welfare Committee decides that since the family is available and to their best knowledge doing reasonably well, depending on how good the social investigation report is, and you place the child back after 8 months or 1 year, and the child is pleading with you to say, don't send me back. I'm happy here. I'm going to school. And yet you send the child back and the child is re-trafficked. These decisions need to be made on an individual case-to-case basis and on very robust social investigation reports that really look at where you're sending the child back. And often these SIRs, the social investigation reports, are not as robust as they need to be. In fact, it would surprise you to know that if you remove the children's names and compare a couple of SIRs, they read absolutely the same. And how can that ever be possible? This is not to belittle people who work in child protection. It's a lack of training. It's a lack of protocols. What are the developmental needs of a child? Nutrition, nurturance, attachment, affiliation, affection, opportunity, encouragement, safety, and so on. And I think that because of the nature and the culture of institutions, we call these as institutional cultures, and the whole philosophy of welfare, if you look at welfare institutions in many socialist countries where taxation is very high, whether it is for children with disability or whether it is old age homes, their state-run welfare institutions are five-star because they look at welfare as an entitlement, as a right. Our welfare institutions, because of their history and the fact that, you know, they dealt with abandoned children and so on, where welfare is not looked at from the lens of entitlement and right, that people ought to be grateful because at least this is, we rescued you from trafficking, didn't we? So why are you angry all the time? You should be grateful kind of an approach does not really work.
So what is the most common issue or a problem which a child who has lived in a child care institution talks about during a counseling session?
One of the common things that have been reported is a continuing experience of loss of agency, of choice and mastery, and a compromising of aspiration. Now, aspirational dynamics, the freedom to dream, the freedom to aspire, in terms of the development of personhood, you can do a lot of other things, you know, education and literacy and job training, vocational training, shelter deployment and all of that. And perhaps if there are mental health issues, you know, treatment of anxiety, if there's trauma, trauma-informed care and all of that. But beyond that, to the larger level of identity and personhood, for a child in an institution to believe that and to experience that what happened to me here was that I was given the freedom to dream and the freedom to aspire. Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing? The other thing that happens in institutions, of course, is in some ways exclusion. If you look at institutions for very young children or institutions of children with disability, unfortunately and concerningly, they are the worst run. Because these children don't have voices. At least in a boy's home, a child may say ki ye chawal achha nahi hai, I don't like this rice. It's quite possible that he may be shut up to say, chup rahe, tere ko biryani khana hai kya? I mean, keep quiet. You want biryani, is it? but it's an exclusion of an experience. Even a staff member passing by a child and a child says, "Good morning, sir," and you don't greet the child back and you walk on. And the impact that that has on the child to feel, you know, maine namaskar bola, response hi nahi tha. Does Didi not like me? Did I offend her? Is something the matter? So you see, that's the range of experiences that, you know, children can endure.
According to the Juvenile Justice Act, when a child is abandoned or the parents are deemed unfit to care and provide for them, they're usually placed in a child care home after due verification. Through this entire process, when authorities are making all these decisions, is a child's opinion considered? Do they get a say in deciding whether they want to live in an institution or with family? Though the JJ Act recognizes a child's right to participate, this right rarely ever gets exercised. Dr. Sheshadri tells us how important a child's choice is in situations like these.
It's a non-negotiable principle. We also need to understand that the choice of the child is not a simplistic process as to say, kahan rehna hai batao, where do you want to stay, with the family or here? It's not as simple as that. It's a process, and by process I mean that this is not a one-off conversation. It is not a one-line question-answer process. It's several sessions of understanding the child's context and background and the pathways through which the child has actually come into the institution. It's looking at what the child's abilities and skills are, what the child's gifts are. It's about where those abilities fit into the kind of aspirations and a future image that the child has of himself. You know, where do you see yourself 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 20 years from now? What do you see yourself doing, and how can we enable that? This becomes a proactive discussion and discourse. It's a way of building a narrative which is so empowering for the child, because the boy or the girl in question then feel that they are part of this emerging narrative. They are constructing their stories based on hope and based on enablement. And it is also a life skills approach, because you're looking at the pros and cons. This is not to vilify your family or to say the institution is the best, or this is not to say how long will you stay in this institution. So this approach is kind of Socratic. The child may not have access to a lot of information and knowledge of the possibilities. It is our obligation to place those possibilities in front of the child. You're not saying, this is the institution, I'm telling you, you have to go there. To say, this is an institution, have the child visit, have the child see a couple of other places, discuss the pros and cons, narrow down choices, and then you respect the choice that they make, because you've given them a very robust framework to make that choice.
A paper on care for orphans and vulnerable children compiled by the organization Faith to Action states, and I quote, "Growing up in the nurturing care of a family provides children with love, a sense of belonging, and a lifelong connection to a community of people, shared history, and culture. However, for millions of children around the world, extreme poverty, disease, and other socioeconomic issues put families at risk, threatening their ability to provide for and protect their children. The best way to serve vulnerable children is to strengthen the capacity of families to care for them." Now, to understand the philosophy of strengthening families better, Satyajit talks to Subhadeep Adhikari, Program Manager of Child Protection at the Jharkhand Unit of the Child in Need Institute.
Who are the members of the community that you're exactly working with? Or when you speak about the stakeholders, who are the stakeholders?
The primary stakeholders, as I've mentioned, the parents, obviously, because the child is in the family. So the family or the parents, whether they are own biological parents or the extended families, they have a larger role to play in safeguarding the child rights and the basic entitlements. Apart from that, we have the basic service providers like the Anganwadi Sevika, the Anganwadi Sahiya, the village Mukhiya or the Pradhan, as we say in our rural language. Also, the village level child protection committee, as I mentioned, as per the ICPS, this is one of the important body of the community who are having the ownership of safeguarding the child rights. They have the rights and responsibility of dealing with these child issues. Apart from that, we have the SMCs, the school management committee, the teachers in that community who are working for child education. So these are some of the primary stakeholders at the community level with whom we work very closely, working on multidimensional aspects. So when we talk about education, and if the child is a dropout, it is not only an issue of education, this is an issue of child protection as well. Because if a child is not going to the school, he or she might be vulnerable and is working somewhere else. Or maybe a marriage is going to take place, that's why the child is not being sent to the school. Or he might migrate and is working with some, you know, bricklayer or in other, any other factories. So that's where we try to address these education issues with the child protection in convergence. If the child is malnutrient and if he's not getting adequate food, so that's an issue of health and protection as well.
Village-level child protection committees are supposed to be established in every village of every state to prevent, report, monitor, protect, and respond to issues of child rights and child protection. If they're trained well and strengthened, issues like trafficking and child marriage could get tackled at the village level itself. Subhadeep explains how a functional and well-trained VLCPC carries out its responsibility with an example.
I would like to quote here an example that we have from my field that happened in one of the area where we are working. So a marriage was about to take place of a girl who was around 16, I would say, 16 years of age. We have these adolescent groups in our communities where they have their monthly meetings. So in one of those adolescent meetings that happened in that particular village, the adolescent girl shared that one of the girl is getting married and this needs to be solved or this needs to be addressed because the parents are in a position to get rid of the child because they would then migrate and settle down in some other states. When this case came up to the adolescent group meeting, the children raised this case in the child protection meeting with the VLCPC. And since the BDO, the block development officer, is a nodal person for, you know, prohibiting child marriage, when the VLCPC had a discussion on this case, first they tried to, you know, convince the family members of the child. The child protection committee members and the adolescent girls both jointly went to that particular family. And they tried to have a discussion with the family and make them understand about the pros and cons of if the child gets married and why it is illegal and what kind of legal provisions are there if that marriage gets happened. So at first instance, it didn't work. The parents were very much rigid and they didn't entertain the committee members and they didn't allow the discussion to go ahead further. So they called up the BDO and they called the DCPO, the District Child Protection Officer, and mentioned that this is some of the case that we have heard, so we need your help. So the BDO and the DCPO, along with the Childline team, came to that village, along with the VLCPC members. A joint meeting was held in the community where the parents were convinced or made them understand about the pros and cons as per the act and how this can jeopardize the child's life. And ultimately, after months of counseling and follow-ups and visits, the marriage got stopped. The girl is now very much happy and doing well in the community. She is continuing her studies. This is a very classic example of how convergent mechanism helps in addressing child rights. Because if you know about your responsibilities very well, if you are empowered to take decisions and to go and, you know, talk with the right people with the right intention, I believe that change will happen and people will listen to you. So that's where we try to empower village people in decision-making process and also fight for their rights.
Now, depending on the case and the circumstance of the child, the law asks for them to be placed in an institution or with family. In the case of the latter, how do we ensure that the children who are living with families are safe in that environment and are not exposed to situations of risk or abuse? Ian explains.
First is that there has to be more awareness about family-based care, so communities can also help the support. But one of the issues we have in India is because we've got such deep religious, cultural, and caste divides, it's very difficult sometimes for the acceptance of a child into a community that is not a child from that kind of cultural, that locality. The second is that foster parents, caregivers, and family members, kin, are given proper training and support to care for that child. So let's take an example of me, okay? If one of my wife's siblings has to come into care in some way, whether it's foster care, group foster care, whatever, and I become the caretaker, then my wife and I both need to have full training of what trauma they might have experienced, how to work with them, how to deal with the transition. So when the child comes into care, there might be a honeymoon period for a short amount of time where they're doing very well and happy, and then behaviors might come up. We also need support through all of those things so we're not alone. So if, for example, that sibling that we're caring for after 2 months has an emotional breakdown, or after 1 year or 2 years, I need to be able to pick up the phone and call somebody and say, I just need a little bit of help here, and not have any of that feel blaming or punishing or punitive. I can't have somebody answer the phone and say, oh, you should be able to deal with that. But rather someone on the phone that says empathetically, that was hard, and here are a couple tools and resources you can use.
Reunification is the process of transitioning a child back to their family of origin. The process is made up of many different steps, and it's not a one-time event. It starts with assessing the root causes for the separation and determining the best way forward. The reunification process also includes preparing the child and the family, facilitating access to appropriate services and support, and ongoing monitoring. But reunification is not always possible. Satyajit asks Subhadeep what needs to be done to ensure that the reintegration is sustainable.
What needs to be done to ensure that the child who is sent back to the family is safe there with the family and the reintegration is sustainable and the child does not need to be placed back in an institution?
This is a very fundamental question that we get every time when we place a child in the family. Because generally what happens, I'm sure you have also seen this in your areas and the work that you are doing, that the district reintegrate a child without having a proper planning or without doing a proper family strengthening plans, developing plans for that, or also and linking the child or the family with those plans. So what we try to advocate in our programs when we work with the district officials, CWC, DCPUs and CCIs, that before restoration, you need to look at the ICP, the individual care plan, as we say. So in the ICP, it is clearly mentioned that what are the proposed action or intervention that needs to be done when you are restoring to a child. And that proposed action intervention should be based on the child's need and the child's attitude or the child's progress or development that he or she has made in the CCI over a period of time. So that document is very important when you are placing a child back to the family. Also, during the assessment, when we do the home visits or the home verification, during assessment, it comes out that whether the family is conducive or not, whether the family is well equipped to take back the child or not. So in that home visits or the home verification, the district need to recommend that what are the needs of the family that needs to be fulfilled in order to restore the child, whether the family has all the kinds of documents that needs to be produced for any scheme linkages, whether the family is having any livelihood opportunities or not that can help in sustaining their integration, whether the bread of the family is having a good source of income or not. Also, we need to understand that if we place the child back to the family, how the education and the health needs will get addressed. So that's a detailed 360-degree plan that you need to do in addressing the child's need and also sustain the reintegration.
There are many reasons for why parents are unable to provide the basic needs in care for a child. And globally, and in most cases, poverty is a leading or underlying reason for the decision to place a child in institutional care. What can be done to help parents and prevent the separation of these children from their families? Subhadeep explains.
The communities and the family need to be very much aligned with the child's basic rights, because when community gatekeeping, as we say in ICPS, the community gatekeeping model needs to be strengthened so that the children do not get separated from the family. So we have done a community assessment, and the community assessment said that the major problems of why children get separated from the families are school dropouts, substance abuse, unstable parent-child relationships, extramarital affairs. In Jharkhand, we have a culture that we say dhuku, which is live-in relationship culture. So out of that live-in relationship, a child gets born and then they abandon the child. So these are some of the top 4 or 5 reasons why a child gets vulnerable and he or she is separated from the family. That's why I said that we need to invest our time, energy in building the families, in building the community-based institutions and groups where they can monitor this child, where they can support the families in counseling services and link the families with the social security schemes. Because a child will only get separated from the family if he or she is not getting that adequate family care, that love, and his basic needs is not getting fulfilled. And all these things can only be possible if you provide that counseling support to the family, if you link the family with the social security schemes or livelihood options where you ensure the basic financial assistance of running a family, realizing the importance of child rights and the child participation, then only you can prevent the child from getting separated. So the community gatekeeping approach, the community work and strengthening the family as a unit is very important in preventing children from unnecessary family separation.
Given the socioeconomic realities of the country, given that there are so many children who are at risk, would it be right to still say that there would be a small number of children who would need to be placed in institutional care for a short period of time maybe, and for that reason, the government should also invest or support childcare institutions to provide quality care to the children who are in these institutions?
The answer is yes, there is small group institutional care for temporary amounts of time in a specialized manner that will be important on a continuum of care. But the danger in saying that there should be an investment in what India calls CCIs, child care institutions, is that a lot of times people hear that investment and go too much on that side. I believe the investment should be in a wide range of family-based care. Now, here's the problem. I believe in many places where DI has happened, deinstitutionalization, there is such a rapid move to family-based care that actually the skills and the ability of the social workforce to keep children safe in families and communities doesn't match the amount of children that's been put in families and communities. So there has to be a transition. So I believe that there is a balance, and then basically, if you can imagine a pendulum swing, where basically we move from big institutional care to small institutional care and specialized care to a wide range of family-based care as we can assure children's safety and protection. But in the big picture, I dream of only the smallest group settings, and I wouldn't even call them CCIs, but the smallest group settings that are supporting children in a specialized way that truly can't be safe within the community. And the rest is strong community-based, grassroots-based mechanisms.
Dr. Shekhar Seshadri and his colleague, Sheila Ramaswamy, have co-written an article called "The Deinstitutionalization Debate in India, Throwing the Baby Out with the Bathwater." In this article, he suggests ways to strengthen childcare institutions so that while the government tries to empower families, CCIs can take care of their children.
So I feel that CCIs need to be empowered to scale up the quality of their care and activities for children so that till we reach some clarity about COVID, at least in the next 3 to 5 years, we will need to strengthen CCIs, build routines where children's developmental, educational, emotional and life skills needs are met, look at a robust aftercare system of where they go, look at their safety, and if they have undergone trauma, to skill the CCIs with trauma-informed care. And indeed, this is what we are doing now in 29 states in two union territories as part of Samvad, where we are looking extensively at duty bearers in CCIs, helplines, to look at these kind of populations so that elegant, simple, and effective mental health and emotional care for children is provided. Also, given the COVID issue and this whole new emerging category of the COVID orphans, children who have either lost one parent or in unfortunate circumstances, both parents, the extended family does not have the capacity to look after them. This is an emerging agenda. It may not have reached huge proportions, but it is an agenda that we cannot afford to neglect. It's not just institutionalization. It's also loss and grief. How do you enable them to address loss and grief issues? So that's the kind of capacitation that one needs to speak about.
Are there any systemic changes that need to take place in India with regards to care for children?
Well, there's no doubt. And the answer to what needs to happen in India is an answer for every country that I've studied in the world, and I've been lucky enough to study a lot. It's two things: philosophical change and coordination of body change. So the first philosophical change is that systems need to move away from the transactionalization of children, that they are children to be removed, housed, and then released. And that's a big philosophical shift. But the second has more to do with how systems need to change. Systems have to work in a collaborative manner. A child that is in child protection also needs to have the Ministry of Education, the Ministry of Health, and any other ministries that are, you know, interacting with that child, working together so that policies and funding streams are coordinated and what I call braided. You know, in India, you know, there's this great, you know, concept of a child's hair, a girl's child's hair when they're going to school being braided together. If these systems are not braided together, we will not be able to truly act in children's best interests.
Thanks for tuning in to Care of the State, a series by Catalyst for Social Action. We would love to hear from you. If you have any questions or want to get involved in the work that CSA does, send an email to connect@csa.org.in. Conceptualized and hosted by Satyajit Mazumdar. Marketing and Communications by Hinal Shah, Pranay Jajodia, and Kinjal Mehta. The creative team were Anuja Kokani and Shahaji Patil. This is a Made in India production. Writer and project manager, Veda Sushila Mohan. Production head and editor, Joshua Thomas. Sound mixing by Karthik Kulkarni. Project supervisor, Sean Phantom. And voiceover by May Mariam Thomas.